Hey, Professor Wolfers, how are you? We appreciate you being back on the Big Talker 1210.
Michael, it's always fun to talk, mate.
Man, you made a lot of headlines last week with this study of NBA officiating. Did it take you by surprise just how far the story was played?
One part did and one part didn't. Obviously talking about race in this country, gets a lot of people on the edge of their seat. So that's the sense in which I probably should have seen this coming. On the flip side, there's a lot of other things I do research on that are arguably more important. You know, things like what are the effects of the death penalty, or what's going on with the changes in the American family, and those bigger picture issues, I'm afraid, don't seem to capture quite the headlines that this one did.
Well, I'm interested in those as well. So anytime you publish, make sure that we see your work, because that sounds like good stuff.
Okay, Michael.
This is Justin Wolfers. He's an assistant professor of business and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's one of the co-authors, he and Joseph Price, who is a Cornell graduate student in economics. And he is one of the gentlemen who found a bias in officiating in the NBA. I'll tell you what I want to do is I want to sort of sit back for a minute or two and give you the floor and ask you, Professor, to tell me how you approach this. How did you go about it before we talk about the results?
Sure. I mean, so there's just to give you a little bit of background, there's questions of discrimination have been, at the forefront of labor economists' minds for generations, and thinking about discrimination used to be pretty easy. It was one group hated the other. It was animus, if you like. Thankfully, that's decreasingly true, and so increasingly social scientists have been looking towards what we think of as being unconscious forms of bias, which is, despite your very best efforts to get rid of any racial stereotypes in your mind, sometimes, particularly split-second judgments, some of those stereotypes might end up informing your judgments. And so we thought, in order to test this sort of theory, that we'd go to the last place on Earth that we thought we'd find evidence of it. And that's the NBA. And the reason I say that's the last place on Earth you'd find evidence of it is I think it's one of the most race-neutral organizations in the world. The referees undergo incredible training. They have incredible incentives to make sure they don't have any biases. And so scientifically, we thought it would be interesting because if you find this sort of evidence there, it's not that this is really a paper about the NBA, but having found it there, I think it makes you wonder a little bit about the rest of society.
So how did you approach it?
We collected as much data as we could is the short answer. We collected data on every foul call over a 14-year period from 91, 92 through to 2003, 2004. It's a database of 600,000 foul calls. And then we coded up the racial composition of the refereeing crew, the racial composition of the players. And the question that we ask in the research paper is, do referees tend to favor players of their own race or alternatively disfavor players of the opposite race? And so the way you do that in what I think of as being a somewhat convincing way statistically, I want to be clear, it's not about black players are treated differently to white players. Lots of people have misinterpreted this that way, including Charles Barkley. It's that black players are treated differently on nights in which the refereeing crew is predominantly white than when the refereeing crew is predominantly black. And conversely, white players are treated differently on nights in which the refereeing crew is predominantly white versus black.
How many referees are there on a court during a game?
There's three. I think I figured that out.
You're laughing at me already.
You're laughing at me, I'm sure.
No, I'm not. Not at all. I ask that because I know one of the criticisms the NBA has of your study is that they say that you looked at calls made by three-man crews, whereas their experts were able to analyze calls made by individual referees.
Absolutely. So let me tell you, first of all, that I've approached the NBA several times over the past year and a half asking for access to their data. And
right.
I'm willing to sign any confidentiality agreement they might be willing to. They might need me to sign. They have no interest in learning, certainly, what sort of answer an established academic would give to this question. They've only ever asked their private sector paid consultants to answer the question for them. But more to the point, this is a very strange criticism. It's a clever one because sports writers don't understand it. But let me tell you how we could sidestep the criticism. Some nights, we actually have just an all-white refereeing crew. Other nights, we have an all-black refereeing crew. So Joe Price and I can redo all of our analysis analyzing how individual players do only in games where it's an all-white crew and comparing that to only games where it's an all-black crew. Well, now I'm pretty darn sure I know the race of the person who blew the whistle. We find, again, exactly the same pattern. Let me explain to you why this is a very strange criticism from the NBA. It's a little bit of an analogy, and maybe it's not a good one. I don't know. You can tell me. The Census Bureau tells us that households that are predominantly African-American are poorer than households that are predominantly white. That's based on an analysis of a household. Now, Michael, how many people are in an average household?
Four.
Right. Now, I could say to the Census Bureau, well, that doesn't tell me anything about African-Americans being poorer than whites. Maybe the household is poor, but actually inside the household, each of the four individuals are millionaires. Doesn't make any sense, does it?
No, I understand. The New York Times summarized your work as follows. They said for the 1991 through 92, then two, for the 91-92 through 03-04 seasons, the authors analyzed every player's box score performance, minutes played, rebounds, shots made and missed, fouls and the like, in the context of the racial composition of the three-person crew refereeing that game. Mr. Wolfers said that he and Mr. Price classified each NBA player and referee as either black or not black by assessing photographs and speaking with an anonymous former referee and then using that information to predict how an official would view the player. That was the one area where I thought you were a little vulnerable, Professor, because some of these European guys, I don't know if they're white or black.
No, absolutely. And I can actually tell you exactly how we did the study, because you don't want researchers making up their own data.
Right.
So I, in fact, coded none of the racial data myself. I gave instructions to my research assistant to look at the photographs and tell me whether they thought a referee would perceive someone as white or black. So this is not a question of ethnic identification. It's, if you're a referee, would you perceive this person as white or black? Now, I understand that in the NBA, first of all, there's a lot of Europeans who may not be, you may think of as a separate category from American whites. Also, there's Yao Ming. And there's many biracial players or mixed-race players as well.
So what do you do with a case like Yao Ming?
Yao Ming is not black. I'm pretty sure of that.
Okay. I mean, he's an Asian guy, so he goes into the white category. On the census form, there'd be a block for Asian.
It's right. And so what we would love to do is do the analysis separately for each of those groups. The difficulty, as I'm sure you can imagine, is that there's very few non-blacks in the NBA. And so as researchers, we can keep slicing the onion finer and finer, but then we'd end up analyzing people rather individuals rather than categories of people. We just don't have enough Asians in the NBA for us to do a separate analysis for Asians. We don't have enough Hispanics to do a separate analysis of Hispanics. I will tell you, though, that one of the things we did to make sure that our results were robust is we asked some of our basketball friends, who do you think are the difficult to classify players? People like Jason Kidd, obviously, Yao Ming. And we took those out of the sample.
Did it change the result?
Not at all. And this isn't surprising to a researcher. I have a sample of 1,200 NBA players, a quarter of a million player game observations. So I can take out small subsets of this or that group, and of course the results are going to be pretty much the same.
Let me ask Professor this question. To what extent does the NBA take race into account when assembling its referee crews?
As I understand it, not at all.
And do you believe that?
Yes.
I wonder if that'll change as a result of your study and the attention that's now been called to this subject.
It's certainly an open question what they should do. This is not my own research, but certainly other research suggests that if people suffer an unconscious bias, maybe there are ways in which we can try and get rid of that. One way, and here I don't want to extrapolate too far from my study, so let me just say it's a speculative suggestion. Let me think about another context. Police have to decide who to stop and search. You might, instead of allowing individual policemen to make that decision, allow groups of police to make that decision, and then one person is a bit of a check on the other person. You might even want mixed race groups. I don't want to go too far down that road because the research doesn't point that way yet.
So if I wanted to sum this up in a statement, tell me if this would be accurate. Analyzing NBA box scores from a 13-season span running through 2004, your study found that black players received fewer fouls per 48 minutes than white players, 4.33 to 4.97. It also found that fouls on black players could increase as much as 4.5% in that time period, when the number of white referees on a crew went from 0 to 3.
Well, Chingo, you're starting to sound like an economics professor, sir.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So the key part of this is that the number of fouls a player gets on a given night is partly determined, and only partly, by the racial composition of the refereeing crew. And that goes both for blacks and for whites. The other thing I should add is that in response to some of the criticism by the NBA, we've analyzed the last 3 years of data to make sure that the patterns we identified over the initial 14-year period continue in to see whether they've continued or reversed. And that analysis is available on my website, and it suggests quite strongly that the patterns we saw from 91 to 04 have continued just as strongly over the last 3 years.
What went on between yourself and the Times? And what I mean by that, Professor Wolfers, is observers found it unusual that this thing would have been given page one prominence, not yet having been subject to peer review.
Yeah, so, I mean, part of your question is a question for the Times, and I obviously can't speak on their behalf. Obviously, it's their judgment that this is newsworthy. As I said at the beginning of the program, to be honest, I think my research on the death penalty might be more newsworthy than research on basketball. But I think that, you know, the national conversation about race in this country has often gone on using sports as the narrative. You know, think about Jackie Robinson onward. And I think that clinical studies of unconscious bias, which have been coming out in dusty old psychology journals for years and years, haven't captured the public imagination in the way that this sort of study would.
Well, did you go looking for the Times, or did the Times come looking for you?
The Times became aware of my study through other academics, and they wanted a copy, and I was happy to provide it to them. And I actually provided it to other journalists.
I'm probably one of the only folks you'll meet who reads the correction and editor note boxes in newspapers.
Yeah.
I took note of the fact that after they put you on the front page, they had a follow-up note of explanation, the gist of which seemed to be that one of the independent experts with whom they'd consulted was someone who'd been the chairman of your doctoral thesis. And they said, we shouldn't have referred to that guy as being independent. What's the deal on that?
That's, again, a question for the Times. So let me explain the process. The Times, I actually have a great deal of admiration for Alan Schwartz, the New York Times journalist. It's very easy with scientific studies to, especially controversial ones, for a journalist to call the other side and ask for a comment, and then report, a boneheaded academic at the University of Pennsylvania says X, but NBA Commissioner Stern says that's nonsense. And then you just get pure he said, she said journalism.
Right.
Sometimes in the world, he's right and she's wrong. And what I admired the New York Times for doing was sidestepping that form of journalism and instead saying, well, who is right? And what they did was they actually talked to a large number of academic economists, not just Larry Katz, and asked them to assess the validity of my study.
Right, but I guess the question, the flat-out question I want to ask you is, as you knew the Times was writing this story, did you, Professor Wolfers, say, hey, why don't you chat with Larry Katz at Harvard?
No, in fact, the New York Times wouldn't even tell me who their independent experts
were. Okay, all right.
And that was to protect the confidence. It comes back to your question, which is, with scientific research, you usually want it to go out and be reviewed by peers. And it's absolutely correct to say that my paper has not been through that formal process yet. But what they did instead was they sent it out for informal review by a whole bunch of experts, and as is standard when doing that, was they promised everyone confidentiality. Unfortunately, I asked someone who had a personal relationship to me. By the same token, this is someone who, when he thinks I'm wrong, I can promise you Larry Katz tells me I'm wrong.
Well, one final question for Professor Justin Wolfers, and we're much obliged that you'd spend time with us and talk about this. It's one of the most widely circulated New York Times stories, by the way, in recent weeks. It's buzzing around the internet. Charles Barkley, among others, said, quote, the thing that bothered me most is these guys didn't go to the game. They looked at the box scores. What do you say to Charles Barkley on that issue?
No, I'm just pleased Charles Barkley didn't say I couldn't play basketball.
Right.
It's one thing to be called a bad economist, but to be called a bad basketball player would have really hurt. I think, so What the essence of Barkley's comment, and that of many other players, is that they're not aware of this bias. Frankly, that doesn't surprise me. We're talking about an unconscious bias, and so we're talking about people whose conscious awareness of an unconscious bias is pretty minimal. The truth is, I had to look at 14 years' worth of data and 600,000 foul calls in order to discern the effect. And to be clear, it's not a huge effect. It's subtle, potentially important, and the implications for thinking about other aspects of our society, I think, are much more important than what we see on the basketball court. But if it's simply not possible to watch 600,000 foul calls in various stadiums, and I'm not even sure in his entire career Charles Barkley has even seen 600,000 foul
calls. I wish that you could isolate for tattoos, earrings, hairstyle.
Right.
And I'm deadly serious on this. Because I think, like, if you dress the part of a gangster, if you dress the part of a bad guy, including on the court, my hunch is I'll bet those are the guys who show up most often as having committed fouls.
You really are an economist at heart, Michael.
No,
I'm absolutely serious. One of the things we did was, a question is it the referees were... Let me rephrase your comment, and I think it's an important one. Are the referees responding to the color of people's skin or to the extent to which they're projecting a certain gangster image?
Right.
The first thing is, by the way, we actually see black referees discriminating against white players as much as we see white referees discriminating against black players.
Mm-hmm.
So that cuts a little bit against that story. The second comment is, it's the same player night to night that we're watching, and the question is, does he do better under white referees versus black referees? That your comment's still important because it might be black referees are more tolerant of tattoos than white referees are.
Right.
We actually tried to get data on tattoos, and if anyone wants to spend time coding up the tattooing marks on various players in the NBA, I would love to run that analysis.
Oh, I would love to see that analysis.
I've actually run something very similar, though. I found a list of all the NBA players who've had criminal charges against them. And so you might think this is not exactly your hypothesis.
No, but is there a relationship between a rap sheet and what you do on the court?
Yeah, and so I can't answer your question, but I can answer the question is, are my conclusions altered by taking account of whether or not a player has a rap sheet? And my conclusions aren't altered at all. Now, that's not in the final research paper.
Well, wait a minute. Say that in an affirmative way. Why don't you say that? Because what I hear saying is...
My conclusions are the same, even when I take account of who has a rap sheet.
Or said differently, conduct on and off the court bear a relationship to one another.
I can't say that. That's
why?
Not the statement I just made. What I just said was the relationship between how... I made a very narrow statement, and I made it intentionally because I haven't done the analysis you suggested.
Say it again.
The conclusions of our study, which is that players are treated differently on nights in which their referees are of their race than the opposite race, are not changed by taking account of who is and who does and doesn't have a rap sheet. You made a different statement, and yours is a very interesting statement. I just don't know whether it's true. You're asking, is behavior off the court related to behavior on the court? And I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. I'm going to have to go back. I got to Zapruder the tape so that I fully appreciate what you just told me, because I think there's a big nugget in there somewhere, but I don't quite understand it yet.
These are very subtle statistical issues, and to be honest, you're a long way ahead of most of the commentary on this.
I really appreciate you being on the program. I'm really grateful to you, and thank you for allowing us to come back, Professor.
I'm really grateful for you being analytic about things.
All right, that's Justin Wolfers. We will podcast this. Did you guys understand that last statement?
So was it right, appearance?
Now, Greg's not going to be the one to explain this to me. TC,
was
please.
Was it appearance or rap sheet?
TC.
Is what you're saying appearance or rap sheet? Because like Dennis Rodman when he played, he had the wild hair and the earrings and the tattoos. You think he committed, they fouled him more than say...
I think if you dress like a pirate on the court, one should not be surprised when the referee treats you as such.
He was saying that was unfounded.
No, he was saying something else, guys. We're going to replay that tape. There's something else going on here.
He was saying that it was irrespective of... whether how they're
has anyone looked at the clock?
Yeah,
has anyone looked at the clock?
I don't even know if traffic is still there.
Is Grace out of town?
I
seriously,
<don't>
there's going to be some issues here.
Yeah.